These are my people, the jazz babies, the hangers-on, second liners, the thrill kids on or off the sauce, who hang around the funk pit clubs at night, saxophones soaring like hawks, a slow gin blues pouring out the door into nights of carnal film noir pleasure and backed up cold turkey pain. On their runs or coming off, moving like animated panthers, loose-jointed Mick Jaggers, symphony Sids on the prowl, looking for kicks. But mostly the good, deep pleasure in the sound. The holy sound, man, that came out of Big Easy, Chi-Town, St. Louis, Memphis, 52nd Street, and KC, man, and then moved into the heart of a country too white and full of hate to see a good thing on bargain basement vinyl. And Duke Ellington went unrecognized until his sophistication just overcame it all. And the Count came over the radio, and later Miles and Mingus prowled stages like shamans, all focused on the sound, the holy sound. These are my people, coming in to hear the music and have a beer, to cram loins and lusty dance, or just relax, rap, share, and signify. Yes, these are my people, and the blues in the night, a long-lost train through America that's coming home, that's my music.
That was Anthony Swan reading his poem, These Are My People. In addition to being a poet, Anthony is, as you could guess, a jazz man. Jazz has been a big part of his life, and to that he has just released his first novel. It is called To Search the Night, a jazz novel, and Anthony stopped by the KBXC studio recently to talk with me about it. You have a deep-seated relationship with jazz music.
Yes, I do. I owe a lot to jazz. What happened was, when I was in high school, I was pretty closed down. I was a real serious little guy. Kept the top button of my shirt buttoned all the time. I was getting straight A's and listened to nothing but classical music. And I was really shut down emotionally, and I couldn't really express myself or feel anything hardly. And a cousin of mine came from Laguna Beach, California. We invited him to share the summer with us. And when he opened up his suitcase, he said, "Here's a present for you." And he handed me two Louis Armstrong albums. Louis Armstrong at the Crescendo, Volumes 1 and 2. They were recorded in the Crescendo, which was a nightclub in L.A. And those records changed my life. The first two songs I heard on that thing, it was just a complete breakthrough. I felt so excited, and for the first time in my life, I could emote and really let my feelings out. And from then on, I just kept following jazz. I kept ordering jazz records. And I had listened to my parents' big band music, and I enjoyed that, but this was what I was really looking for, so it opened the door to a whole world for me.
So then what happened?
Well, after my junior year in college at the University of Minnesota, I dropped out and I went to San Francisco. I think my main motivation for that was the music of Cal Jader, this Latin jazz that I had started finding on record. I just wanted to be closer to where that came from. And of course, San Francisco was a fabled city, you know, it was a city of beatniks and all that. So I got out there, and I ended up in the cheapest place I could find to rent, because I didn't have hardly any money left. And it turned out to be in the Mission District in San Francisco. And I couldn't get any work anywhere. They didn't want to hire anybody that was from out of town unless you had gone to school there, college there, and had roots there. They didn't want to hire any what they call transient people. So I ended up trying to pick crops. There was a bus that was supposed to come in the middle of the night from the Tenderloin to take us out to pick crops. The bus never showed up, but I heard this conga beat, this drum beat in the night. And my friend, my roommate, was bummed out. We were cold and hungry, and you know, we'd run out of money. And he says, "I'm going home." And I said, "I'm going to go see where that drum came from." And I went, and I found it, and it was an after-hours Mexican restaurant. I walked in. And oh, the smell of that Mexican food, just my stomach started churning, my mouth was watering. And I sat down, I had enough money for a cup of coffee, and that was it. And they had a rhythm section there. They had a conga drummer and a piano, and a bass was there. Sometimes a bass player would play. But an old, beautiful old Spanish man came across from the rhythm section and said, I see you're really enjoying the music. He said, would you like to join us? I said, I don't play anything. I said, I fool around on bongo drums, but I don't really know how to play them. And he said, well, you can play the claves. He said, come on over, I'll show you. So I walked over there. He picks up these two sticks of this really beautiful dark wood. And he says, I'll show you the clave beat. And he goes, click, 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 click. And these sticks made this really beautiful sound. And so he said, that's an instrument. He said, that's the most important part, because that beat is the basis of Afro-Cuban music. And he was just very kind and gentle. And so they started playing again, the piano and conga. And by then there was a bass player. And I filled in with that rhythm, and I was a part of the music. It was just this incredible feeling. And then afterwards, they asked me if I wanted to join them. They were sitting and eating, and the Mexican kid brought me a plate of food. He was the conga drummer. And I found out I could take lessons from him on bongos for $5 a lesson. And he lived in the same part of town I did, which was a mission district, Latino Barrio of San Francisco. So then I started hanging out with these Latin musician guys, and I learned how to play bongos well enough to sit in with bands and whatnot. And I was a part of a little band that we went around and played for parties and in a couple of bars in the Mission District. And so that was my introduction to Latin music. On weekends, I'd go up to the North Beach area. There was this wonderful Latin music club up there called the Copacabana. And then there were two really excellent jazz clubs. There was a Jazz Workshop in Sugar Hill. And I heard the greats up there in Latin music as well as jazz. So I was living really well. I wasn't making much money. I finally got a job as a file clerk in a Social Security payment center on Market Street. But I was into hanging out with these Latin guys and their world, you know. It was just beautiful. You go to one of their houses and they pull out a guitar out of the closet and a bottle of tequila or rum or something, and pretty soon people were singing and the guitar music was just fantastic. These people could play guitars just so beautifully. I never forgot that old man, that old Spanish man that introduced me. That was my introduction.
When was that?
That was in 62, okay. 1962. It was a little on the tail end of the beats. I didn't really get into writing much. I met a painter that would have introduced me to one of those guys on the literary scene, but I was more into music.
So when did you start writing?
Well, I had been writing poetry since high school. I really didn't start writing until I got back into Minneapolis. I did a lot of traveling. I went to Mexico for 3 months, and then I went to Brazil later on for 9 months. I had been writing pieces of a novel all along, but really didn't do any serious writing. And a poem came now and then, you know. But I didn't really start seriously trying to get books out until I got here in Bemidji decades later and settled down, quit drinking and running around and settled down. And it just kind of came naturally here because it's so supportive, the art scene here, the people are so supportive. That's really what happened, was their support really helped make it happen.
That is poet and author Anthony Swan. Since I've known you, you did Paint with Words.
Yeah, that was my first book.
Okay, mm-hmm. And now you're following up with that with a novel.
With a novel. Mm-hmm.
That is steeped in jazz.
Yeah, it's about jazz people specifically, and Bohemians and other artists in the Twin Cities in the early 60s.
Okay.
1963, 64 generally. It's fiction, but it's based mostly on people that I knew, things that happened to me, and people I knew or people I'd heard of it during those years in that general area.
Okay. Is this the novel that you said you had written bits and pieces of a novel?
Yes, yes.
Uh-huh. Oh, so this has been percolating for a long time.
Yeah, it's gone through a lot of changes, and then I've had three editors since I started working on it seriously.
So it's called To Search the Night,
mm-hmm.
a jazz novel. Can you take us in there and tell us a little bit about what happens without revealing too much?
Well, it's a story about a young artist struggling to get over, as we used to, expression we used to use in those days, to establish themselves as artists in a rather tepid environment. In those days, they weren't very friendly to jazz in the Twin Cities, I would say, and the culture wasn't as diverse as it is now. So it was kind of a struggle for a lot of artists to make it back then. And so these young artists kind of hung together and supported each other in that way. And it tells of what they had to go through in order to survive, and their joys and their happiness and their sorrows and so on and so forth. It's as realistic as I could make it because I lived through it. The only thing I could compare it to as a novel, it's one of my two favorite novels of all time, Another Country by James Baldwin. Because back then, when I ran into that novel, it was the only thing I knew that described the kind of thing that my friends and I felt like we were going through in our world, which was the same as the world that Baldwin depicted so well in that novel. That's why it struck me so deeply. The other favorite novel is Steppenwolf by Hermann Hesse. And that's, I don't know what to say about that. You'd have to, it just captured my imagination.
I'm looking at the cover of the novel, and there is a beautiful woman with long brown hair leaning on an old mint convertible of some sort. Who is this woman?
The girl in the book is named Sarah. And Sarah was a Jewish girl that I met at the University of Minnesota at Pioneer Hall. We had a co-ed hall there. And she was interested in jazz. She liked jazz. It wasn't a romantic thing. We didn't date, but we just hung out together and had coffee. And I just enjoyed talking to her. I tried to take out her cousin, and her father found out I wasn't Jewish, and he wouldn't let me take her out. But I met her mother, and her mother was a painter. And her mother took me down in the basement of their wealthy house in St. Louis Park and showed me her paintings. And she was a really good painter, and she was very friendly, but her father didn't want me going out with his daughter. But I based the character of Sarah on her in general and used the background of the younger girl in the book as a family situation. And she's one of the main characters. And she becomes involved in this world of artists and bohemians kind of by accident, but they help her solve a family problem. As it turns out, they were the only ones that could do it. And she helps them with her money and is introduced to the music.
Wow. And jazz is a character in itself.
Yes, that's good. I've never heard that expressed that way, but that's probably the main character, yeah. Wow, that's very observant. That's very interesting.
It seems like Minneapolis might be a character too, like the city
itself. Yes. I don't know how Minneapolis will react to that. I don't know if they'll like it or not, but they'll have to take it because that's the way they presented themselves to me, and it wasn't all bad. I had kind of a tough way to go down there, I felt, and it's friendly enough now. It's just back in those days, it seemed a little hostile to minorities and people that were into the jazz world,
okay.
Jazz people.
Minorities and then people also just that are on the fringe a little bit.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes. Outsiders in some respect.
Yeah.
Minneapolis is really a cosmopolitan place now. You know, they've had to be. They've got people from all over the world living there in large numbers. So I think it's a much more open-minded place than it used to be. And Bemidji is a very open-minded town for a small town. So things are changing slowly, I think.
Yeah. How did you end up in Bemidji?
I came back here because I had a good year here at Bemidji State Teachers College, and I had a good feeling about that year that I was here.
Okay.
It was one of the best years of my life, and it just meant a lot to me, and that was in the back of my mind when I wanted to settle down. Plus, I liked the town, too, and nature here. I mean, it's just incredible around here, the natural life around here, which means a lot to me now.
Yeah. Well, do you want to read an excerpt from the book?
I sure will.
Or maybe you could set it up for us a little bit.
Okay. This first excerpt is from a part of the book where the sax player Boris has a job playing in a pit band behind strippers in a strip club. It's one of the only jobs that he's able to find as a musician. And his girlfriend is injured. And the musician who was coming to see him at the bar tells him about it. So he tells the band leader, he said he was going, and the band leader says, "You go and you're fired, you and the whole band. I got customers waiting for that last number, and you're going to play it." Boris realized how badly the musicians needed the gig. "All right, you cheap son of a bitch, I'll play, but I should just walk." Boris went on stage, snapped on his sax, and began a slow, intense blues. The other musicians, who had been waiting to play something previously agreed upon, held back in surprise. The panic Boris felt over Lucy and all the frustration he was carrying, the cold, blind alley system of the white city he felt trapped in, all that emotion began coming out of his horn, first in rushes, then torrents, a blues so strong, so raw and powerful, that the people all looked up. They stopped what they'd been doing. The girls quit hustling, and all the jabbering, horny fool men shut up. The bartenders stood still as statues. The musicians were keenly alert. They were almost afraid to touch what Boris was playing, but the drummer began a simple, tentative beat. The bassist joined and then the piano, all of them holding down for Boris to blow strong and heavy. Blues now poured through him with the power of a great river, blues which he used to ignore and pay lip service to only while he emulated John Coltrane and explored modern jazz. He had taken for granted the blues that lay like bedrock in the collective subconscious, taking for granted blues' truth, which he always recognized and felt deeply when he heard it, and was now pouring out of him with the fury of an unleashed dam. Boris came down off the mountaintop that night in the sweat, the funk of that fleshpot club. He sensed a new power in the blues and kept them in his style from then on. If only a tinge of it like Bird always kept, a blue edge to his wings that sang like Kansas City. Boris had finally begun to fuse his own style, opened the door to let the blues in. He emerged from Coltrane's shadow with his own voice, an axe, a sword newly sharpened with a razor-sharp blue edge.
So that's based on somebody that you probably knew?
Yeah, that's based on Boris Wilson. I dedicated the book to him. He was a sax player that played in a jazz coffee house that me and a black friend, artist friend of mine started at Cedar Riverside a little later from these years here. He was just a wonderful musician. He also became an actor, and he acted in the Penumbra Theater. He played saxophonist Lester Young in a play at this black theater in St. Paul and did a good acting job as well as being a musician.
It seems like there's a lot of social lessons buried in this story.
Well, I identify with minorities because as a jazz person back in those days especially, I felt like I was a minority. I was a white guy, I had all the white privilege, but, you know, I was hanging with jazz people, and I knew how they were treated, and I knew how hard it was to break through as any kind of an artist, and we all have to, especially in this climate that we're living in now, politically, is that we all have to be more tolerant and more understanding of people that are so-called different from us.
Yeah.
Because we're all human beings, we all have blood and heartbeat, and I keep learning that lesson all the time. You know, I have to look at how I might diss people in my mind and why, and none of it seems to hold up, you know. A compassion and love, that's the thing that we're supposed to learn.
Yeah, that's interesting. I hadn't thought about that. You were a white guy, primarily surrounded by
black people.
You were the minority.
Yes, I was.
And that gave you a
perspective. Especially in the Mission District. I went to a Latin dance hall several times where I was the only white person there. And they took me in. I didn't feel any hostility at all, which I'm thankful for. You know, I mean, but I was young and naive and I didn't know the difference anyway. I was so in love with their music. And apparently they could sense that. You know, they knew that.
That is Anthony Swan. His new book is called To Search the Night, a jazz novel. I'm Katie Carter. You're listening to Area Voices on Northern Community Radio. The jazz music you heard in the background of this interview was created by Sam Miltich. Area Voices is made possible by the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and by the people of Minnesota.